Well, my name is David Nassar. I'm the Vice President of Communications here at Brookings. I just want to welcome all of you to this event. And I want to thank the Foreign Policy Program and the Global Program at Brookings for organizing this, and specifically Gail Chelleff and Mao Lin Chen. And I'm going to turn it over to Mao Lin, who is now going to moderate the roundtable.
Okay, welcome everybody. You all have gotten my email, and so to introduce, we have Jeffrey Bader, who is Senior Fellow in International Diplomacy at the Brookings Institution's Foreign Policy Program. Dr. Bader returned to Brookings after serving in the Obama administration as a Senior Director for East Asian Affairs on the National Security Council from 2009 to 2011. Prior to his appointment at the Obama administration, Dr. Bader was the first Director of the John Thornton Center here at Brookings on China. And then to my left here, we have Eshwar Prasad. He holds the New Century Chair in International Trade and Economics here at Brookings. He's also the Tolani Senior Professor of Trade Policy at Cornell University. Prior to being at Brookings, he was previously the head of the Financial Studies Division and the China Division at the IMF. And then Dr. Chen Li is Director of Research and a Senior Fellow at the John Thornton China Center and in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. He focuses on the transformation of political leaders, generational change, and technological development in China, and can talk about domestic politics within China as well. So why don't we kick it off with Dr. Bader, and then Eshwar, and then Dr. Chen Li?
I should be happy. So just might be useful for some of us just to know who's here and then who's on the phone. Is that the...
Sure.
We could go around and just introduce ourselves.
Just what entities people are with.
Okay, I'm Laure Mandeville. I'm the chief U.S. correspondent for the French Daily Le Figaro.
I'm Michelle Kellerman with NPR.
Tony Kimmenau with AFP.
I'm Ermad Honey with USA Today.
Leslie Clark with McClatchy Newspapers.
George Condon with National Journal.
I'm Jackie Combs, New York Times.
Ken Fine, Voice of America.
And then on the line.
Hi, I'm Christy Parsons from the Tribune Newspapers.
Hi, Lisa Lair from Bloomberg.
David Taylor from the Times of London. And Peter Foster from the London Daily Telegraph.
Joe Shaw.
Jeffrey Yellen. Jeffrey Yellen from CNN.
Joe Shaw from NHK.
Pauline Nelson from the Wall Street Journal.
Okay. Rick Dunham, Houston Chronicle.
Josh Gerstein with Politico.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, thank you. It's a good turnout and demonstration. There's a lot of interest in this event. I'll just talk for a few minutes. I'd much rather get into questions and answers than speechify you all. This is obviously a very important event and a somewhat special event. There was, President Obama met with Hu Jintao, I think, about a dozen times in his first term. There was, I think, some unease in the White House and U.S. foreign policy establishment generally about the large gap that might be developing before President Obama and President Xi would have a chance to meet. That in the normal course of events, the first opportunity probably would have been September at the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg. So a decision was made on the U.S. side and the Chinese side to try to do something sooner. I think the feeling, even though it was coordinating calendars is always a challenge. The feeling was that there really was a special opportunity here and a necessity to try to get this relationship onto a higher level and to do it sooner rather than later. Part of it is the opportunity presented by China's new president, Xi Jinping. He just assumed the presidency in March at the National People's Congress meeting and just assumed the general secretaryship last fall. So he's new. And he's a different kind of Chinese leader than we've seen in the past. He is someone who is clearly comfortable with give and take, with informality. He's not someone who needs to be scripted likes to be scripted as much as past Chinese leaders, and I think therefore the White House felt that they could arrange a meeting with him that would be of a different character than the past meetings. The past meetings have basically taken two forms. One is on the margins of international meetings like the G20 and APEC and East Asia Summit, And two is state visits to China, state visits to the United States. And the Chinese have always insisted that the first visit by a Chinese leader must be a state visit. I've gone through this for 25 years with the Chinese and have the bruises to show for it. We've always liked something more informal, and frankly, we've never gotten it. In this instance, Xi Jinping, I think perhaps to the surprise of some, somewhat surprising me, decided this was a good idea. And agree, I mean, that's part of the big story here, is that he was willing to have a meeting in California, not in Washington, not a state visit, no 21-gun salute, no White House welcoming ceremony, no state dinner. The Chinese have always felt that the celebratory and protocol aspects of the visit were a big part of what the meeting was about in terms of their demonstrating to their own public that they're treated with respect. Xi Jinping is apparently sufficiently comfortable. He doesn't feel he needs that. So we have this meeting in California, which will be allow for much more extensive discussions than the normal meeting on the margins of a multilateral meeting. There might be, I don't know the exact schedule, but I would say probably about three times as much time they'll have together to talk over the course of 2 days in small groups. My guess is to have some one-on-one time. And the meetings themselves probably won't have more than, I don't know, five or six people on each side. I'm used to meetings with the Chinese where you have 20 or 22 people and you have bleachers in the back. So you have a much more candid, different kind of discussion in this kind of setting. The last thing I'd say by way of introduction, let's not take too much of the time on intros here, is I think that there'll be three dominant issues. So this is a meeting. You know, the White House always likes to say before meetings that it's not about deliverables, it's about the relationship. It happens to be true in this case. This really is about building a personal relationship between the two and trying to, I won't say develop a roadmap, but develop a sense over the remaining years of the Obama administration and Xi Jinping's first term about how we build a more cooperative, substantially more cooperative relationship between the two sides and to try to get the two presidents comfortable with each other. To build some personal trust to do that. I'd say that, so I'm not looking, there'll probably be some analysis of some kind, there invariably are, but that's not really what this meeting is about. It's about the relationship building aspect. But I think three dominant issues, I'd look the issues to be North Korea, to be the economic relationship, and its various manifestations bilaterally and multilaterally, and cyber issues. They have enough time to talk about everything, but those are, I think, would be the three topics. That's all I said by way of introduction.
Ashwan? So this is a very opportune time for the two leaders to meet. The political season is behind the U.S. and the leadership transition in China is mostly past. The leaders in both countries are now very focused on their domestic economic agendas, which creates a little bit of space to foster what I think is a very important bilateral relationship in both economic and political terms. The informality of this setting, as Jeff pointed out, is a very important issue. China is clearly comfortable with itself and doesn't need any further ratification of itself as a great power. And I think there is a strong sense right now that these two powers are jostling a little bit and getting to know each other better. There are going to be bumps in the road, some small, some big. And having a very informal relationship both at the senior levels and also at the technical levels is going to be very important to get through these inevitable bumps in the road and smooth over them. On the economic front, again, there is space for a much more productive relationship to be fostered between the two. The traditional flashpoints between the two countries, the currency issue and trade, have sort of diminished as flashpoints. And they remain minor irritants in the regime because the U.S. would like China to move forward on its currency appreciation. But the real opportunity here lies in the fact that China and the U.S. now have a commonality of interests. The Chinese leadership has made it very clear that it intends to move forward aggressively with a domestic reform agenda. They're not counting that much on exports anymore to bolster their growth. They're looking to push forward a significant range of domestic economic reforms. And the Obama administration could play a very constructive role right now by endorsing and supporting those reforms. it's not that the U.S. can really prod very much in terms of getting that much action, but I think every bit of technical help, every bit of support that the U.S. can provide to the Chinese while they fight their internal domestic political battles is going to be very important. Now, the currency issue is something that will come up, and there is a ritualistic element to it. The U.S. will bring it up and say that China does need to be moving more aggressively on its currency. The Chinese will say that they are moving towards a more market-determined system of exchange rates, and then the issue will be set aside. It can't fully be ignored because the bilateral trade deficit that the U.S. runs with China did reach an all-time high last year of about $315 billion, and that number, although there are very good reasons not to focus on it, is what gets a lot of attention in Washington. So I think there will have to be some acknowledgement of the issue about China's currency and about the bilateral trade deficit. But on the economic front, one significant change is that there has been something of a leveling of the playing field in the last year or so. The U.S. economic recovery is by no means strong, but it is on firmer ground than it was about a year ago. The Chinese economy, by contrast, is losing momentum. Now, it's not that the Chinese are converging to U.S. growth rates. There is still a very large gap in the growth rates. But there is this subtle shifting of the playing field. So it's become a little more level and perhaps a lot more level than it's been in the last few years. So that, I think, also makes it a much more productive basis to conduct a dialogue where the two countries can really focus in a pragmatic way on what they need to do to move forward their relationship. And China is also clearly becoming more open to engagement on economic issues, including opening up its markets and in particular on trade. China, I think, felt unfairly left out of the TPP, and they were somewhat ambiguous about whether they wanted to be part of it or not. Recent signals suggest that they would like to be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I think eventually there will have to be some role for China, because it's hard to see this relation, this trade pact making very significant progress without China being involved. So China has subtly but very, very slightly, I think, shifted to the defensive on some of these economic issues. They want to make sure they don't get left out. And I think the U.S. has, again, very subtly tried to maneuver a little bit around China by building stronger relationships with other countries in the Asian region. So I think there is a clear sense on both sides that they want to approach this in a pragmatic way. And if they do that, they can get past the irritants and make this a really productive relationship between the two countries.
Now Dr. Chen Li will speak.
My assignment is to discuss internal social political scene in China, which is very important for us in understanding the motivations, constraints, and the possible impact of Xi Jinping's visit. Now, I would like to make three observations. First, President Xi Jinping has had a honeymoon period during the first several months since last November when he became the top leader in the party, largely because he has enhanced the great expectation across many social political groups in China. Second observation is that this honeymoon period is coming to end much earlier, based on my observation, much earlier than the previous generation of leaders, largely because he has increasingly alienated many elite groups in the country, including cultural elite, economic elite, some political elites are also concerned about the anti-corruption, maybe only deal with local leaders, not the senior level leaders. And especially, he alienated the liberal public intellectuals. This is the second point of observation I want to make. Thirdly, the Obama-Xi Jinping summit is crucial for President Xi Jinping to consolidate his power back in home and to define his foreign and domestic policies. And it is also important for President Obama to seize this really great opportunity to help Xi Jinping choose the right path for China and also to be on the right side of history as the top leader in China. Now, let me very quickly elaborate on these three points. First, about the honeymoon period that he enjoyed in the past several months. It's largely because of several factors. First, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao were not popular, you know, towards the final years of their leadership. Secondly, in the wake of the Bolshevik crisis, you know, a couple of years ago, that the party had tremendous incentive united under Xi Jinping. So he certainly achieved that goal. And thirdly, I think it's most importantly, he really presented himself in a very skillful way to reaching out to the different social groups and appeal them in terms of some of the hot button issues. Now, there's four comparisons in China and abroad to compare Xi Jinping with other leaders. First is the argument that Xi Jinping looked like Deng Xiaoping, because the first thing he did, he had a sudden journey, really like what happened in the early 1980s, opened up the China's economy, very reform-minded. He also said very interestingly that Chinese Communist Party should put power in box, which really deal with corruption. He implemented the so-called 8 regulations, anti-corruption, to a certain extent changed the behaviors of the Chinese officials. And also, in the early months of his leadership, he talked about constitutionalism. This is the first time a top leader so closely talked about, emphasized the importance of judicial independence and etc. Now, this is the metaphor, he will be another Deng Xiaoping. The second, just opposite, from a more conservative side of society, think he's another Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao. Now, this is based on several things. One is he's a princeling, so he's kind of inherited this kind of revolutionary, you know, tradition. And also, he heavily emphasized nationalism, especially the role of the military in China's foreign policy, and to a certain extent, domestic affairs as well. And he even used the term to talk about the first 30 years of the PRC is equally impressive than the second 30 years. Now, this is actually its breakthrough. Previously, people said that the Mao era has a lot of flaws, a lot of problems. So this is, again, a new leader to glorify Mao era. This is at least perceived by Chinese liberal intellectuals. And finally, he actually quite astonishingly endorsed the so-called three confidences: confidence in the role China has taken, confidence of the communist ideology, and confidence in China's political system. This is astonishing for the Chinese liberal intellectuals, even for economic and the political elites. They thought that these kind of things was subject to debate. Now, the third view is from foreigners think he will be China's Gorbachev. Now, this, I think, is a very, very bad metaphor. I hope that during his visit, foreign leaders should be careful using that term, because we are so obsessed with our own perspective. We consider Gorbachev is a hero, but let's face it, Chinese, 99% of people think he's a failure. And say that he is a Gorbachev is a curse. Now, interesting enough, that California residents to host him, actually, it's exactly the time that President Reagan saw Gorbachev's speech. I hope that you will not make that kind of comparison, because it will resonate very, very badly at home. He will be very offended. Now, the fourth one is one which I endorse, is he could be China's Jiang Jingguo. Jiang Jingguo is a leader of Taiwan in the 1980s, also a princeling, the son of Chiang Kai-shek. But he is also conservative. But all of a sudden, he opened up the Taiwanese political system and become a very, very successful story. Now, that question still has not been answered. I think that card probably is the right question for us. He is neither Deng or Mao, because the historical circumstances will not allow him to achieve that objective, no matter how, you know, people present him or whether he's interested in becoming one of them. It will not happen. So Jiang Jingguo, whether he becomes that kind of figure with success to open up China's political system, is a question yet to be answered. Now, let me move to the second thing very quickly about why honeymoon period coming to end. Because increasingly, he already presented himself as a leader, politically conservative, but economically liberal. This is the term Chinese intellectuals use frequently in the past few weeks. Now, politically conservative, because you see very tight control of the media. There's no further talk about a political reform, at least in the past few months. No longer talk about the rule of law, even, and also that the anti-corruption sounds like caused more cynicism in China, because the two trials, Bolshevik trial and the railroad minister trial, sounds like will end up in a way not to satisfy the Chinese expectation. Now, but economically, he is a liberal, and as my colleague also already mentioned, that's important because he has a wonderful economic team, very good in terms of economic reform, not only in the top level, like Wang Jishan and Zhang Gaoli, and etc., but also in the next level, like Zhou Xiaochuan, Liu He, Minister of Finance, Zhou Jiwei. They are all brilliant economic reformers. So they will carry out economic policy. But the question is, at the moment, Chinese public is extremely cynical. They believe that reform-minded policy, including financial liberalization and the change of the local central tax revenue, will go nowhere because interest group is so powerful to block these policies, particularly the interest group of state-owned enterprises. And also the economic, so far, after 6 or 7 months he become top leader, the economy has not improved. But you see the property bubble continue, and also the most pressing issue is that college graduates could not find a job. Previously, about 20 to 30% of college graduates could not find a job. This year, there will be 7 million graduates. The statistic from China is this time is the highest unemployment, higher than 30%. You know, could be even as many as half of them could not find a job. Now, this is we talk about 3.5 million people. That certainly create a very disturbing situation. Most of these college graduates are middle class family members, or they are future middle class. To a certain extent, that group also become increasingly worrisome. Now let me move to the last point, why I think it's a great opportunity. Because I think that the US president and also for scholars like us, we can make a point, just like the Chinese public intellectuals constantly make a point. In today's China, economic reform should go along with the political reform, the political change. You cannot separate them. And to a certain extent, that this kind of political conservative, economic liberal policy cannot go too far in today's China. So I think President certainly should say in a very respectful way, from learning lessons of our American dream, our own problem, and also we should show our goodwill for China. We want to be stable transition in China. We hope that Xi Jinping is the person, can push for all these changes. I still very hopeful. And also, this is really related with American values, we should not hide it, but whether it should be publicly or privately to talk about these issues, I don't know. But in China, there's a rise of concern that kind of a political conservative nature will really eventually will cause some explosion. So that's a very serious matter. I'm still hopeful. I think that highly likely that Xi Jinping will make a choice whether he wants to be the right side of history to be China's Jiang Jingguo, then really leave his legacy. Certainly that he knew deal with very, very powerful interest group, but an international successful trip from the United States will give him the incentive to move that direction. Thank you very much.
Okay, now time for questions. Just so for the people on the call, I'm going to go to questions in the room and then also on the line. Can we just make sure we say who we are beforehand? Yes, go ahead.
George Condon of the National Journal. You talk about a subtle shifting of the playing field. I mean, who has the leverage at this meeting?
This is Ishwar Prasad. The issue is more a bit of a shifting towards a more level playing field, so I wouldn't characterize it as either party really having an upper hand and having any leverage over the other. The major challenges that both sides face are really domestic at this stage, as both Jeff and Cheng have pointed out. There are enormous challenges in Beijing because there is a very clear agenda that the leadership has, and they're finding it very difficult to actually make progress because they are facing not only opposition from vested interests, but also trying to deal with the loss in growth momentum at the same time. And of course, although Cheng has pointed out that it would be nice if President Obama could talk about U.S. values, given the mess that we have here in Washington, perhaps Obama's mind is also very much focused on the domestic challenges. So in that sense, the issue is that given the amount of focus that is there in both countries on domestic issues, there isn't that much of a need for these two leaders to play to the domestic audience by bashing either China or the U.S., as the case may be. So in that sense, I think both sites may find it useful to get out of this meeting the sense that they have support for their domestic economic agendas. In the case of China, for reforms as the way to move forward and engage more with the international community, and for the U.S. perhaps to make its contribution to engagement with the world by getting the right things done at home.
Well, if I can follow real quickly, but at some of the past meetings between the leaders, there's been a sense that the Chinese didn't have any reason to give in. They had the benefit on the trade surplus and so on. Isn't that different this time?
I think the quid pro quo is very much the same as it was in the past. What the U.S. would like is access to Chinese markets. It would like to make sure that its financial institutions and firms can enter China, invest in China. What the Chinese would like is more access to investment opportunities in the U.S., and they would also like access to U.S. technology. Now, this gets tied in with a number of other issues that Jeff referred to in terms of cybersecurity and so on. But I think this is a good time to make progress on that quid pro quo, because there is a very clear bargaining element with neither side having a particular leverage over the other, but each side potentially having a lot to gain through a good bargain with the other.
If I could just add one point, I think your question probably was prompted primarily by Eswar's observation and deals mostly with the economic side. But I would just add on the political and security side that I think that President Obama probably feels that that we have established credibility in the region through the strategy of rebalancing over the last few years, that the strengthening of alliances with Korea, Japan, with Australia, the joining of the East Asia Summit, the beginnings of an umbrella agreement on TPP, all of the trips back and forth. I think there's a sense that the region welcomes the U.S. presence, that they have manifested that clearly over the last few years, and that I'm not sure I want to get into the vocabulary of leverage, but I think that puts the U.S. and the president in a comfortable and strong position as they meet with the Chinese.
Do we have a question from the line? No? Okay. Go ahead.
A couple of things. First of all, Secretary Clinton used to talk about this, trying to answer the age-old question of what happens when rising powers meet established powers. There's some people like Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister, who suggested that what needs to happen is these regular summits. This should be a normal channel. Is that what you see happening? Is this the first step in that direction?
First, on the question of rising powers and great powers, I mean, that clearly is very much on the minds of both sides, I'd say, especially on the Chinese side, this term of a new type of great power relationship, a new type of major power relationship, which the Chinese first put in play, which the United States has somewhat mimicked. This basically deals with that question, Michelle. It's what they mean by that is a different kind of relationship than historically rising powers and dominant powers have had. They've studied history, they've studied the writings of international relations theorists in the West, and they know that that rising powers and existing powers, the relationships between them, tends not to end happily. They've had documentaries on their on CCTV talking about past rising powers. They've thought about this quite a bit. So this slogan, if you will, this mantra, that's really what it means. They haven't fleshed it out very much as to what kind of relationship. Really, it's almost a negative. What kind of relationship don't we want to have? So far, in terms of fleshing it out, there isn't too much more than the notion that we need a much more cooperative relationship than past rising powers and dominant powers have had. And sorry, the second part of your question, Michelle?
Whether this is...
I think President Obama from the beginning has felt that he wanted to have a regular rhythm of meetings. As I say, he met with Hu Jintao a dozen times in his first 4 years. That's, I'm sure, much, much more frequently than his predecessors have done. So I don't know that this is new in terms of... I don't think it's new in terms of establishing a rhythm. I think what's important here is how early this meeting is, how long the meeting will be, the informality of it, and the objective of really having a strategic discussion where we really try to understand each other's strategic objectives so that we can not so much solve problems today, but over the next 4 years solve them.
Yes?
Hi, I'm Jackie Collins from the New York Times. I think it was you, Mr. Posada, mentioned the TPP and China. And we saw that it took a while to get Japan involved, and it seemed when, in that November 2011 Asia trip, that a lot of the purpose of TPP was a bulwark against China and its size and growth and power. How will the other countries on the Pacific Rim react to the prospect of China being part of it?
I don't think China is a particularly welcome guest to the TPP at this stage, because as you point out, there was a strategic objective to the TPP of essentially pulling together a set of countries that could act as a bulwark against China. But in this very room, as a matter of fact, we had a large group of Chinese intellectuals making a very powerful case that China felt it was being unfairly sidelined, and that a trade relationship or trade agreement in Asia that excluded China would not make any sense at all. And China, I think, would like to make sure that there is no end run around its role in Asia. And I think the fact that at least in the last few days we've seen some signals that China would like to get involved in the TPP at some future stage is indicating that it doesn't want to be sidelined in this process. But I think your sense is correct that given the origins of the TPP and what the other participants seem to want out of it, I think there is a sense that it is meant to be a counterweight to China rather than something that incorporates China.
Can I just add a little bit from my perspective when I was in the administration on this? I think there, the philosophy of the original participants in this was to try to negotiate what they call a higher standards agreement. And the higher standards certainly would include some sort of a way of dealing with state-owned enterprises. So the notion that, I'd say, that China would be in on the ground floor of such a negotiation probably did not come naturally to people in the White House, but Vietnam is. So I think there's some feeling that that disciplines can be imposed through this negotiation process on state-owned enterprises through the Vietnam participation that assure that these enterprises behave in a commercial fashion, not a politically controlled and politically driven fashion. That if the high standards, including in the state-owned enterprise sector, emerge from this process, then the partners would be in a good position to approach the Chinese and say that this is an agreement that you can sign on to. I guess the other point I'd make is that China is not passive. China has its own FTA negotiation process. China has more FTAs in the region than we do. They have an FTA with ASEAN, and there was recently the announcement of what's it called, the RCEP.
You haven't seen any China-related like press calls or like, well, that one, yeah.
But anyway, China and the other members of EAS have announced negotiation of a multilateral trade agreement that excludes the U.S. It includes, what is it, all the ASEAN countries and Australia, New Zealand, India, China, Korea, Japan. They excludes the U.S. So, at some point, all of these different processes are going to have to be melded if it's going to be a rational outcome.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to the question of the cooperative versus adversarial relationship between China and the U.S. I mean, if you make a comparison of what is happening between Russia and the U.S., I mean, we know that Russia defines and focuses its foreign policy basically as opposing the U.S. Basically, that's the center of the Russian foreign policy. But what is happening with the Chinese? I mean, what drives their foreign policy and therefore the definition of their relationship with the U.S.?
Okay. Well, for China, in the Chinese mindset at the moment, the country matters most is the United States, because this is a country that could successfully, from their perspective, you know, to form an international coalition to deal with China. And this is also a country that economically is so important. But Chinese leaders, you know, the message from private meetings in the past few months constantly express, you know, they value the U.S.-China relationship. They certainly want to put that relationship back on the right track. But publicly, they need to deal with the growing kind of criticism or national sentiment, because the U.S. does that, you know, support some of the U.S. allies in South China Sea and also East China Sea. And so therefore, that leaders need to be concerned about this kind of rise of nationalism. So therefore, their first trip, Xi Jinping's first trip, is go to Russia, and Li Keqiang's also go to Africa and some other countries. And so they wanted to form kind of, you know, China's own outreach, to use that as kind of a bargaining power to, you know, deal with the United States, but at the same time send a more balanced message to a domestic audience. So this is the mindset of Chinese leaders. Whether they can do well or not is subject to, you know, the events, how that unfold in North Korea, in China's relation with Japan, and also trade relationship, and also whether this trip will be perceived as very, very successful to enhance China's international prestige, to really have a good moment to accelerate the development in various areas, be it economic, climate change, you know, cybersecurity, et cetera. So that's why the visit is so important at this very crucial moment, because Xi Jinping needs to make a choice, need to define China's foreign policy. That will also impact to China's domestic policy, policies. You cannot be you know, a respectful player in the national domain, but domestically so conservative. That is a contradiction. So they, these things will usually come together.
If I could just add one point. Basically, I think your question, comparing Russia and China, put it correctly. I think that the Russians, Russian and Chinese concerns about the U.S. are, you know, overlap substantially in many ways. In many ways, they're similar. But the Russians, they like to stick their finger in our eye. They like to have sort of visible disputes. They like to stand up to the U.S. In their political culture, this is valuable and important. The Chinese do not. The Chinese, there is, as Cheng Li is indicating, this undercurrent of nationalism and anxiety about U.S. intentions. So the concerns are somewhat parallel to the Russians. But they like to mute these differences in their public discourse with the United States rather than to highlight them.
Yes. Dan Roberts from The Guardian. Jeff, you at the outset set out the agenda, I'm guessing, particularly how the US sees it, mm-hmm. Korea, yeah. Economy, cybersecurity. Is that how the Chinese are likely to see their priorities in that order? And in particular on cybersecurity, are the Chinese likely to want to talk about that in any great depth? Is there much they can do?
You're right. I mean, when I said that at the outset, I should have made clear that was the U.S. U.S. perspective. The Chinese perspective, as you indicate, will be different. Of those three issues, certainly the economic relationship would be in the top two or three on the Chinese side, as on the U.S. side. I think that North Korea would be near the top on the Chinese side right now. The experience that they've had the last few months watching the behavior of Kim Jong-un has really had a profound impact on Chinese thinking. And they are going to want to compare notes with President Obama on North Korea. So I don't think that we'll have to chase them down to get the North Korea discussions going. Cyber is different. Cyber, the Chinese, I would say, will be in the defensive posture. They would be just as happy if this issue were not highlighted.
Do they regard it as a serious issue? Do they buy into the U.S. narrative that this is a government-led exercise?
No, the answer is they think that China has been treated unfairly. They think that certainly, I think that economic and the North Korea will be it will carry more weight, maybe some other issues as well. And but the China is willing to talk about that issue, I do believe, because they wanted to. They understand that issue dominates American media at the moment. Certainly, it's not conducive for a healthy and cooperative relationship. China wants to expand its position, but at the same time, it's everyone's interest to have the cybersecurity. So therefore, I hope that the Chinese will take a good, leadership will take action to deal with this kind of domestic, this kind of espionage or cyber attack. But at the same time, we should put perspective. Not when you think about that issue, just single out of China. And this kind of fear probably is counterproductive for everyone, right? It is a real issue. It's a very serious issue. But it's only through cooperation to make China to do the right things. So this is also a great opportunity. For China, they also want to seize the opportunity to expand China's position, China's own fear, and also sense of kind of unfairness. I think maybe they have a problem.
If I could just add one thought, just to frame the cyber issue a little bit. I mean, I think of the cyber issue as having sort of three basic components. One is espionage. Two is theft of intellectual property. And three is sabotage. Okay? The response to each really needs to be quite different. On espionage has been going on for a few thousand years. This is simply espionage using new tools. And so, frankly, we've never had much luck at getting mutual restraint on espionage in the past before this tool was invented. I don't expect we'll have much success now. So on the espionage side, I think the challenge is simply we have to build our defenses as strong as we can. And I don't know that there's an awful lot we can ask of the Chinese that we'll get, just as I don't know that they'll get an awful lot of us on this subject. Okay. The third one, sabotage. That's the most chilling one. That's when you turn on the TV and you see trailers for movies and you see people pushing buttons somewhere and the White House exploding and the U.S. grinding to a halt. And there has been some mention of this in some of the recent reports, like the Mandian report did talk about sabotage. My own view is that sabotage by China against the United States or the United States against China is a very extremely low likelihood. Why? Because we each have a tremendous stake in the success of each other's economy. China doesn't have an interest in seeing the U.S. financial services sector grind to a halt by a cyber attack. Maybe North Korea or Iran might, but China does not. And I think also both sides recognize that there is the functional equivalent of mutually assured destruction in the sabotage area, that if one does it, the other can do it, and it will not end happily. So the real crux of the problem for the U.S. is the intellectual property theft area. That's the one we care about. And that's, frankly, asymmetric. The Chinese do it, and we do not. So trying to get agreement on that is a challenge. I'm sure we won't get agreement on that this week. We need to start a process of development of international norms that the Chinese will buy onto in the intellectual property area that's going to address those concerns. From the Chinese point of view, it's critical because the chief foundation of support for U.S.-China relationship in the United States historically is the business community, and the business community is the one that's being hurt by this intellectual property theft, and they're the ones who are agitated about it.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions from the line?
Yes, it's Jessica Yellen from CNN. If I could just follow up on that last point on intellectual property and cyber security. We don't expect any deliverables from this meeting. What is reasonable to expect, or what would the White House want going in as a result of this meeting on that front? At least an acknowledgement from China that this is happening and that they'd like to make some progress on these norms? Or is there some sort of concrete development you could see coming out of this meeting?
I'm uncomfortable sort of speaking for White House precise objectives, because I don't know exactly how the discussions would go, but I would speak personally what I think would be most useful in that regard. I think the opportunity here is that Xi Jinping sits atop an interagency mechanism, a process in China. You've got lots of different actors on the cyber issues in China, most of whom have their own head of steam and probably are not paying much attention to guidance. I think it's important for President Obama to impress upon Xi Jinping that this is not just the flavor of the month, that this is a hugely important issue that's not going to go away and it's going to corrode the relationship, and that Xi Jinping has to personally take charge of the issue within the Chinese system, not just let the PLA building in Shanghai or others run loose on this. So it's an attempt to do kind of a top-down sensitizing of the Chinese. And the second thing is, I think SOR alluded to this, to get a process going to develop norms, international norms. We're really fairly primitive in that area. If they can come out of this summit saying, we have a process, we have working groups, we are rejuvenating a process of international negotiation of norms in this area to prevent theft of intellectual property and to prevent sabotage, and the two sides agree on these principles, I think that would be a pretty decent outcome.
More questions? Yes.
Following on that, how much does the noise from Washington, whether it's the business community or Congress calling on the president to essentially call Xi to the carpet on cybersecurity, is with balancing what you saw from the beginning, is that this is the president is looking at the long term with this weekend's meeting. How do you balance the two, and specifically, is the noise helping or hurting going in?
First of all, I'm going back to an earlier question. I don't take seriously the Chinese denials that they're engaging in. I don't think anyone takes that seriously. They're kind of non-denial denials if you read them, and I don't think anyone is thinking that what's really important is to get the Chinese to fess up. That's, we know what's happening. They know what's happening. So I'm not concerned with that, achieving that objective. As for, the this question between division between private candor and public space. I think that if the president's already been pretty vocal on this issue publicly. Okay. I think that coming out of the meeting, frankly, if we have very sharp public rhetoric about Chinese activities, I don't think that's going to help. I think what's really important is, we already have the rhetoric out there. We've already got the report by DOD, the president's statements. I think what's important is to have the private discussion where Xi Jinping is persuaded that this really matters and that the president is not seeking to embarrass him publicly on the issue, but is really seeking to develop changes in behavior so that this issue doesn't metastasize through the whole relationship. So the domestic pressure, that's nice, as Swar said, this is a nice thing about being in the second term. You have somewhat thick skin about domestic pressure on some of these issues and actually look at the long term.
Do you want to take the last two more questions over there?
Turn to North Korea. What would be a good outcome from the meeting in terms of a statement? If there's no statement, is that an indication that they're just not on the same page at all? There was some talk in recent weeks that Xi's sort of pressure on North Korea, given its recent provocations, was some characterized it as a gift to the U.S. in advance of this meeting, and others said, the Chinese don't do gifts; they're more transactional than that. What should we look for coming out of North Korea?
A couple of thoughts. First of all, in terms of the public messaging and the capture of what's discussed privately, how that's going to be done. My understanding is it's not going to be a joint statement. There will probably be, my guess is, briefings by senior people, on the record briefings, by a senior person on each side. Pretty good idea of who it's going to be, and that would capture the public messages two sides want to get out. Okay. And that would presumably cover North Korea, cyber, all these other issues. Secondly, I have very little doubt that Xi Jinping is deeply disturbed by what's been going on in North Korea. That this is not that what we've seen in China in the last few months is not simply a gift to the U.S. or a bow to the U.S. That they're really, really irritated. When you see a phone call by the president of China to the new president of South Korea, publicizing the phone call, very warm phone call, talking about President Park Geun-hye visiting China soon. She's a visit, I think, this month. That phone call and that message would come out at the height of the North Korean antics. That's a pretty powerful message. The decision to close the Bank of China accounts of the North Korean trading company, that was a pretty powerful message. And just the public debate in China generally, with all these scholars writing articles saying we've got to get rid of this North Korea burden, that's meant to be a message to North Korea. In my own meetings in China recently, the message has been very strong that we, China, will never accept a North Korean nuclear capability. We will never accept it. And that's kind of how they begin meetings. That's not how Chinese began meetings in the past on the subject. They usually begin meetings by saying, oh, what's most important is return to six-party talks and peaceful resolution, and you Americans have to be sensitive to North Korea's security concerns. So all of these elements are still in the Chinese position, but the emphasis has distinctly changed. So I think the most important thing to come out, I don't know if they'd come out with a specific announcement that they're going to do A or B, I doubt it, but I think what they really want to come out is a message to Pyongyang of solidarity between the United States and China on the North Korea issue, so there is not space or opportunity for North Korea to play one side against the other. A posture that increases the pressure on North Korea to understand it's got a binary choice. It can continue its nuclear weapons program, or it can have economic development and acceptance in the international community, but not both, and that both China and the U.S. agree on that.
Any more questions from the line?
Yes, could I ask one?
Yes.
Hi, it's Scott Wilson from the Washington Post. Thanks very much for doing this. And my apologies, I was a couple of minutes late, but so if Dr. Bader covered this in his talk, just ignore it. But I wanted to ask a little bit about just the informality of a meeting between an American leader and a Chinese leader. When I think of Chinese diplomacy, informality isn't the first thing that comes to mind. And I'm wondering how you think the informality may or may not work in a setting like this. And if you could point to something in history, either between a meeting between an American leader and a Chinese leader, or an American leader and another head of state, that you think might be comparable to a meeting like this.
Well, Scott, yeah, I did talk a little bit about the informality at the beginning. I didn't expand on it, but I did make the point that it's unique in the history of U.S.-China meetings, that, you know, why bother having meetings if you're just going to basically read the People's Daily editorial? You know, you can send that in the mail. And this Xi Jinping is much more comfortable in this kind of setting. He's demonstrated that. Vice President Biden talks about it from his own experience. He spent 10 or 11 hours with Xi Jinping on his visit to China. But informality, I mean, one thing it does is it builds a relationship, hopefully a relationship of trust between the two leaders. Now, there's a lot of talk about strategic distrust. You know, that's not a phrase, frankly, I use, and I don't believe that it's all that easy to overcome strategic distrust between countries. It's based on objective factors. Okay, but trust between individuals is real. And they don't have to have the same ideology. And so private time, informal time between the two, in which they talk candidly about their own political situation, their own strategic, their own economic policies, talk about what they're seeking and what they're fearful about, that can build a personal trust. And if you've got personal trust, then in future crises, you've got some capital you can draw on. You know, you can call the president of the other country, and you can ask for things and get a higher level of understanding than if you haven't built that kind of relationship.
Okay, Eshwar is going to make one comment, and then Chen Li.
Jackie, the Chinese do give gifts. The gifts are transactional themselves. So, like, just before summits, you get a little bump up in the currency, you get a little favor on North Korea, and so on. But I think, latching this question onto what Michelle asked earlier, my sense is that China is quite confident in itself as a great power, and that is one very important symbolism that is coming out of this, the nature of this meeting, that they don't need the pomp and circumstance to ratify themselves as a great power. And what I think President Xi would really like to take back home is this image of him and Obama in shirt sleeves and with their, well, not quite with their hair down, but essentially in shirt sleeves, getting down to brass tacks, dealing with each other as equals. And that is the image of getting down to business that I think would really serve Xi well back home.
Well, just to add one thing, it's not entirely unprecedented, because we know that personal relationship always carries much weight from Chinese perspective in state-to-state relations. In terms of U.S.-China relations, Jiang Zemin's visit in Texas and in the ranch of George W. Bush Jr. was an example. You can also trace earlier that the Nixon's visit in Mao's studio, this kind of one-on-one personal conversation carried much weight. So that's certainly the things Xi Jinping wants to achieve. That's probably the opportunity for U.S. to do the same things, to build up kind of a mutual respect, understanding, maybe even friendship.
I guess Chung is absolutely right on that, but the Waco meeting was at the end of Jiang Zemin's tenure, so if you will, it was kind of a gift for past friendship and performance rather than a launching pad, whereas this one has more of a forward-looking quality.
Okay, so sorry, time is up. There will be a full audio and a transcript, and we'll send it to everybody on the line and in the room. Otherwise, you can contact us if you have any interview requests for these scholars. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.